Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 14th, 2005. This session is Take Off Your Shoes, Putting the Shoes Back On, presented by Rabbi Robert Marks in the Fireside Room. Disc number MAR-2005-09. Let's listen in.
We come to the end of our journey today, and for me, it's always, always such a wonderful journey. To be up here with the best word that comes to my mind is serious people. And I'm not using that in the sense of being dully ponderous, but rather people who are seriously committed to seeking a way, to seeking the truth, to seeking a path to faith. And you do so, I've characterized you as serious, you do so with a sense of humor and a sense of openness that is a joy to behold. I'm going to try to do three things today. I want to bring this journey, which I began a week ago Monday, to a temporary close, at least as far as I'm concerned, and there will be other and much greater scholars taking over and the future who will be able to give different insights. That miracle is always a possibility. So the three things I would like to do today are, one, to deal with all too briefly Moses in a way that we haven't been able to deal with him in terms of Moses' greatness, his uniqueness, his power, and secondly, to deal with the whole dualism that comes into Judaism and subsequently into Christianity, which leads us to be able to comprehend the idea of heaven and hell, of a heaven, a better place, an ideal place, in some perfect world. And also will help to understand, if you carry it to its logical conclusion, the Messiah idea, which is present in both faiths, the belief that there is some perfect being, either who has come, or in the case of us, Jews, who is yet to come. But at any rate, the idea is similar and congenial to us both, and in a sense unique to us, to both of our faiths. And I think sometimes we ought to appreciate that uniqueness instead of quibbling over whether I'm not going to set the parameters, because that in itself becomes part of the argument, instead of quibbling about what the Messiah means in our traditions. And I'd like to end with a description of how the Midrash treats the death of Moses. With that in mind, let me simply start out by saying that during these 2 weeks that I've been with you, I have purposely dwelt with the passages that lead up to the theme of our year, which is Take Off Your Shoes. And it is a passage that, as you know by now, because whether you got here last night and participated in the worship last night, or have been here for a year or even 2 years, as many of you have been here, sometimes longer, you'll know that the passage, Take Off Your Shoes, is a call to humility, is a call to openness, is a call to a willingness to revelation, to some new experience. Moses has that new experience. He starts out with this ambiguous and ambivalent life. Is he an Israelite? Is he an Egyptian? Is he a refugee? Is he a prince? Is he a usurper of the throne? Or is he a usurper of power among his people? Are you going to do to us what you did to the Egyptian taskmaster? One of the Hebrew slaves says to him before he has to flee into the wilderness. And of course, we leave Moses, for the most part, as somebody who is simply a shepherd out in the field, who is leading the simplest life, and he gets his call to greatness. And as we saw in our session together yesterday, Moses keeps provoking God, and you can see the dialogue, which is an unbelievably marvelous and frank dialogue between God and Moses, in which God is telling Moses all sorts of things. God says to Moses, "I will be what I will be. I am Ehyeh Asher Ehyeh Yahveh." And that doesn't mean anything to Moses. And then God continually brings it back and says, "I'm the God of your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." And according to the liturgy last night, he says also Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah, which was an interesting addition to the text, but one of which I heartily approve, because in today's vocabulary, that's certainly an important emendation. And if the biblical writer weren't a male chauvinist, I'm sure he would have included that in what God really said. At any rate, Moses keeps saying, "I can't do this, I can't." Moses keeps saying, sort of an equivocal, "Send whom thou wilt send, send whom thou wilt send." And one could see God's increasing infuriation with Moses. "You keep saying, send whom thou wilt send, and here my people are suffering." And Moses says, "Look, according to the Midrash, you haven't made clear what I'm supposed to do." And Moses says, "Send whom thou send." And Moses says, "Well, look, then what's going to happen to all the children and their pregnant women, and where are the midwives coming from? In other words, where's the backup logistics for this operation that you're asking me to engage in? It isn't there, and I don't know what I'm, you know, why am I going to?" So God send whom you will send. And then finally Moses says, "The truth of the matter is I'm slow of speech." Well, for a guy who's slow of speech, after this chapter, he says a hell of a lot. Because he keeps talking, and Ruth accuses me of that, talking and talking and talking. He talks all the time. He comes down from the mountain and says 10 very important things, among other stuff that he does. Pretty good, right? All of a sudden, he's not mincing words. He's giving commandments. Those 10 words. And he's giving instructions, and he tells people what to do. And once in a while, he pauses to listen to advice, as when after the Exodus takes place and the children of Israel are out in the wilderness, and they start to quarrel among themselves. And here I'm doing what I always do. I'm thinking of something that amuses me, and I'm going to share it with you right now, because I am uncontrollable. Congregation, a rabbi in the congregation, and the rabbi retires, and now he's 98 years old, and the congregation is sort of struggling to get along without him, and they get into an argument about the prayers on the second day of the festival of Sukkot. And they have these violent arguments, see, and he's now retired many years, and they keep finding that on the second day of Sukkot, which is the harvest holiday in the fall of the year after the high holidays, there's a prayer insertion, and they get into these terrible, terrible arguments about it. And finally it becomes so bad that they have fist fights about it. They actually start, to come to blows over the thing. And they decide, maybe we better send a delegation to see Reb Moshe, Reb Lee Moshe, the old rabbi. And so they appoint 5 people to go in to see the rabbi. And the poor man is probably breathing his antepenultimate breath. He's on his deathbed. But he takes these 5 people, come in, they say, "Rabbi," he says, they said, "we have these terrible arguments on the second day of Sukkot and about the prayer, the addition of the prayer on the second day of Sukkot and the tradition. And we want to know what the tradition is, because we are arguing so much about the tradition that we actually come to fist fights on the second day of Sukkot. Please, Rabbi, tell us what the tradition is." So the rabbi strokes his beard. He's lying there. He says, yep, yep. He He says, that's the tradition, fist fights on the second day of school. So poor Moses is confronted by these conflicts, and Jethro, his father-in-law, who is also called Reuel in parts of the Bible, Jethro is called upon. Jethro comes to his son-in-law and tells him to appoint judges, and we get one of the important bits of legislation that is often overlooked in the Bible, that just judges are critically important to any just society. So that story is worth more attention than we have to make, than we have given it. Moses' life is not easy. It's full of quarrels. Moses is not, I'm sorry to say, Moses was not a pacifist. Moses didn't go gently into that good night. Moses was from this conflicted young man who's standing as a shepherd in the wilderness and reluctant to take off his shoes and turns aside and wonder. The young man who says, send anybody but me, I'm slow of speech, I don't know what to do. Moses suddenly emerges now into something that we could spend a whole summer talking about. The types of leaders. He becomes the authoritarian, the charismatic leader, whose followers want to proclaim him the Messiah. And we're going to see, if you'll just take a look quickly, just very quickly, just so we don't leave Moses as that simpering young man standing barefoot, as we will now see him in a whole different sense. Please take a look. Daryl, our reader, will lead us through this. First to Exodus 32, verse 1, the golden calf. Just so we see what happens. Exodus 32, verse 1. This is familiar to everybody, but it's one of the travails that Moses had to experience, is standing before the golden calf. Go ahead.
When the people saw that Moses delayed to come down the mountain, the people gathered around Aaron and said to him, come, make gods for us, who shall go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him. Aaron said to them, take off the gold rings that are on the ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters, and bring them to me. So all of the people took off the gold rings from their ears and brought them to Aaron. He took the gold from them, formed it in a mold, and cast an image of a calf. And they said, these are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of this land of Egypt. When Aaron saw this, he built an altar before it, and Aaron made proclamation and said, tomorrow shall be a festival to the Lord. They rose early the next day and offered burnt offerings and brought sacrifices of well-being. And the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to revel. The Lord said to Moses, go down at once. Your people whom you brought up out of the land of Egypt have acted perversely. They have been quick to turn aside from the way that I commanded them. They have cast for themselves an image of a calf and have worshipped it and sacrificed to it and said, these are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. The Lord said to Moses, I have seen this people, how stiff-necked they are. Now let me alone, so that my wrath may burn hot against them and I may consume them, and of you I will make a great nation. But Moses implored the Lord, his God, and said, O Lord, why does your wrath burn hot against your people?
Okay, now, look at this. In the first place, earlier in our text, Moses is saying, you know, I can't go, I'd send somebody else, I can't do this. You know, he's arguing with God about that. Now look at how he's arguing about that. Now he's the defender of his people against God's wrath. But he has his own wrath, you know. I mean, Moses is not a patsy. He goes down the mountain, what does he do? What does he do with those two tablets? Yeah, I want more than sign language in this group, okay? Go ahead. No, you were the one.
Yeah, he breaks the tablet.
He breaks and smashes the tablet. Right. In anger, right? Mm-hmm. Smashes the tablets. Has to go up and, you know, I'm not sure that God didn't add a few things that he had maybe forgotten the first to the second one, but then we get, you know, we were able now to decorate the Texas courthouse. And courts in Georgia, too. But Moses is now angry, and Moses comes down in anger. He's defended his people against God. This is sort of a leader, incidentally. You know, you defend your people against the outside, and you get angry as hell at them for what they're doing wrong on the inside. And there's some leadership lesson here in terms of what Moses does. It's interesting that Moses is told he's not going to enter the promised land. Now, Aaron, who's done this terrible thing, he gets off scot-free. I've always been fascinated by this. Moses can't get into the promised land, but Aaron, you know, it's like they're apologizing for Aaron. God says, well, Aaron couldn't help it, and there's midrash about this. Aaron couldn't help it because the people wanted to do it, and they miss Moses and their leader, but he can't get into the promised land because, well, we don't know what it is. It's sort of ambiguous.
Always get off scot-free.
The what?
The siblings, yeah.
But this is an older sibling. What, you think he said my younger brother did it? My younger brother went away, so I did it. Okay. I mean, remember, Aaron is the older of the two. And he's supposed to be the guy who's speaking for Moses. Well, he doesn't speak for Moses. And anyhow, briefly, one other little conflict. If you'll take a look at Numbers 16, verse 1, and we'll see how Dathan, who keeps popping up in the Midrash, I mean, Dathan is present with Moses as a little kid, and Korach and Dathan, number 16, verse 1, if you will. Yeah, just read a little bit of this, because I don't want to leave Moses as sort of the little innocent by the burning bush. He's certainly not.
What chapter again?
16, Numbers 16, verse 1. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers. That's number 4.
Now Korach, son of Ishar, son
Korach.
Of... Korach, son of Ishar, son of Korach, son of Levi, along with Dathan and Abiram.
Levi is Moses' family, remember? Yeah, okay, go ahead.
Sons of Levi, along with Dathan and Abiram, sons of Eliab, and On, son of Peleth, descendants of Reuben, took 250 Israelite men, leaders of the congregation, chosen from the assembly, well-known men, and they confronted Moses. They assembled against Moses and against Aaron and said to them, you have gone too far. All the congregation...
Now, wait a minute. I put that down because your translation is so fascinating for me because I'm reading the Hebrew in my mind. Okay? It's the passage is... Vayikach Korach. Korach took. Now, your translation says, most of you, it says, they took men, right? Doesn't it say they took people?
Yeah.
They took people. It doesn't say that in the Hebrew. They took. And Moses is saying, you took too much. It doesn't say they took. It doesn't say what they took. The assumption is, the translation to make it easy for us, because we like to see things literally, says they took men. What they did was they took power. They were taking authority, taking it away from Moses, and Moses won't let them do it. Moses answers, the word took appears over and over again, if you'll read this, and I'm not going to spend the time to do it now, because I want to do the two other things that I've set as a goal for today. That they go back and forth about you. Moses then, in this passage, somewhere along the line says, you take too much upon yourselves, O sons of Korah. Doesn't that say that there? The bishops that are here and the pastors and, you know, hidden clergy people of all kinds. You remember that they go back and forth with the phrase, they took. And it's never defined what they took. They're taking is a form of need. Taking, you take too much on yourselves. And Moses is saying that it's only God. And you're taking power. And God won't let you do that. So the life of Moses is not easy. And he finally leads his people, as you know, over the sea, waters of the sea. He's led them out in the wilderness. He's fed them manna and spent 40 years. You know what 40 years in a wilderness wandering around is? Moses has led his people for 40 years. And now we're going to come to the end of his life. I hope we've come to it with a little appreciation of some of the struggles he's endured. In order to deal with the Midrash with which I'd like to end this course, I have to spend a few moments with philosophy with you. Judaism and Christianity owe a great debt to Greek thought. It was Socrates, and Socrates as seen through the eyes of Plato, who introduced into the Western world what, for a want of a better term, philosophers tend to call Platonic dualism. Plato offered arguments, and using Socrates as his mouthpiece, or Socrates was his teacher, offered arguments for a perfect world out there, not here. In the Republic, there is the image of the cave and the fire. We here in this world see truth and everything around us, but imperfectly. Gary, to my left, is sitting with a shirt of many colors and many patterns. There is perfect shirt. That's not it, Gary, I'm sorry to say.
Almost perfect.
When you wear it, it becomes nearer to perfect than before. We see an image of a horse. Several of you have cited bears, I must say. Not far from Holden Village. Was a cougar sighted the other day? I'm told. There's a perfect horse, perfect bear. But more important for our purposes, in this world we seek justice, but in some perfect world out there, there is perfect justice. We are the imperfect imitations of a model that out there beyond us, in a realm far beyond us, is perfect. Plato gives, I think it's in the Phaedo, those of you who are philosophers, that wonderful argument for the immortality of the soul, for life after death. And he's talking to one of the people in the dialogues. I haven't read this in many years, I'm recalling it now, in which Socrates says to his dialoguee, he says, things exist because of their opposites. For instance, you will admit that there's such a thing as sweet. What's the opposite of sweet?
Sour.
You wouldn't know sour if you didn't know sweet. Okay? Let's take love. There is such a thing as love. What's the opposite of love?
Hatred.
We know hatred because it's the opposite of love. Or let's take something much simpler. How about light? Okay, we know light. What's the opposite? Darkness. You've been here for many years, so you know the answer. You must have heard me tell you the answer to that. The opposite is darkness. You will admit that the opposite of dark is of light is darkness. The opposite of day is night. The opposite of justice is injustice. We wouldn't know justice unless we knew there was such a thing as injustice, and we know that there's justice because we know there's justice. Will is Sakhamis. If we know that good comes from evil, and night comes from day, and justice comes from injustice, don't we know that there's life? And what is the opposite of life?
Death.
We know life because we know death. All right? And we know that life is the opposite of death. And if we know that night comes from day and day comes from night and justice comes from injustice and injustice comes from justice, and if we know good comes from evil and evil from good, and we know that there is such a that life leads to death, why then isn't it absolutely certain that death comes to life? The argument, an argument, there are many more, for the immortality of the soul. It's called the argument of the opposites, the immortality of the soul. Well, let me simply say that the ideas of heaven, of a perfect world can be translated, I gave it away just now, can be translated very easily in religious terms into heaven. Heaven. There is a perfect world out there. Now, you know, you do find the word heaven in the Bible. But it's not a place where people go. It's a physical location where God is. God created the heavens and the earth. That's all there is. And the heavens are the skies. Do you see in the Hebrew Bible any reference to people going to heaven? You don't. Well, maybe in Daniel, maybe in the very, very latest books, you find some reference to it. There are some intimations of it in Daniel. But ladies and gentlemen, you simply do not find heaven as a place. What happens to people when they die? You tell me. What's the phrase in the Bible? What do they do? What? No. They sleep with their fathers. They sleep with their fathers. The idea of a heaven is an idea that comes into Judaism in Hellenic times. And Hellenic times means the period about 200 years before the birth of Jesus, the time of the Maccabean Wars. You've heard of Hanukkah? And I maintain that Hanukkah was a holiday about freedom. Hanukkah is a minor Jewish holiday, which has suddenly become the Christmas of the Jews. And it never was. Hanukkah is a minor holiday celebrating a military victory over the Maccabees, which was caused, I think, by a Jewish rebellion against the infusion of Greek customs coming into Judaism. And the first person, incidentally, in that Maccabean War, and Jews always get upset, my religious school adults, when they study with me, always get upset when I tell them that the first person killed in the Maccabean Wars, which led to Hanukkah, was not a Greek or a Syrian. It was a Jew worshiping at a Greek altar. Because Greek, and what does it illustrate? I hope I'm not being too elliptical. It illustrates the infusion of Greek ideas into Judaism, and whenever new ideas come into a religion, there's always conflict, as there was conflict when Christianity and Judaism start to emerge against each other in the first century. The new ideas are Greek ideas. And what Jews were fighting were Jews going to the Olympic Games, you know, in Caesarea, and what was to become Caesarea, and other centers of Greek thought, and the cities were becoming centers of Greek thought. The rebellion against the Syrians in the Maccabean War, which took place in 165 BCE, the rebellion took place in Modin, the Hicks, the Sticks, out in the country, a little town called Modin. And they end up going to Jerusalem to rededicate the temple, but Jerusalem is the big city. And the temple has been desolate and ignored, and they go back to the temple to dedicate the temple. Well, this is maybe not of interest to you, but certainly relevant to what I'm trying to suggest, and that is that during this period, Greek thoughts were flooding into Judaism, and with them the idea of a heaven, of a perfect life, and now the argument becomes within Judaism, and the argument between the Sadducees and the Pharisees is this. Do we simply die, or is there going to be the possibility of resurrection? If we simply die, what happens? Well, both parties now are willing to say something that they never said before. The soul is immortal. That wasn't in Judaism before. That's not in the Bible. That's not in the story of Moses. The soul is immortal. And the new Pharisees are saying not only is the soul immortal, but there will be a resurrection. That's the argument that preceded Jesus. That's the argument you have to understand was in Judaism. What's going on in Judaism? Is it just the soul that lives? And even the argument about the soul living, that was about 200 years old. But 200 years is a long time, you know. We can fight over what the Constitution means today. And that's a little over 200 years old. Why can't we fight about resurrection, which was 200 years in coming into Judaism? And now we're fighting about immortality of the soul, and now we're fighting about resurrection. And they start to fight, Sadducees and Pharisees. They didn't always get along with each other. The Sadducees were the priests in the temple. The Pharisees said they're stooges of the Romans. They're the priests. They're stuck in their old conservative ways. As a matter of fact, the arguments became so vital and so virulent that the Pharisees, in some of their writings, say, because they didn't have he, she type of thing, they didn't have Abba, Ima, he who denies the resurrection of the dead has no share in the world to come. Listen to this. How bitter they got. If you deny the possibilities of resurrection, you don't have any share in the world to come. Well, you've got to understand how this leads up to the life of Jesus. This whole argument in Judaism is essential to understand in order to understand not only the life of Jesus, but the arguments about Jesus. The arguments about Jesus between old Jews and new Jews, between Jews and Christians, and what form it takes and whether it's real. And in this process, there were lots of things added. The Messiah will come at Passover time. Why? Because Moses came at Passover time. The Messiah will liberate. The Messiah will liberate people from this terrible Roman rule. The Messiah will be a descendant of King David. Why King David? You tell me why King David. Why do you think King David?
He was the greatest power and authority.
He was the great power. Look, under King David, the kingdom of Judea expanded to its greatest limit. David was a military man. Messiah itself was a political role. Moses was political. Moses was not a spiritual leader. That was taken from him, according to the text, and given to his brother Aaron. Aaron was the head of the priests of the Levites. Moses was denied that privilege. separation of church and state. I'm lumping a lot of stuff together, but I think it all connect. I hope it all connects in some way for you, because it's so important that it does. Moses was the political leader. Aaron was the religious leader. But Moses was not to be the Messiah. And the proof that he wasn't the Messiah is that he doesn't go into the promised land. That is denied him. Well, let me pause for a moment, because I've thrown out an awful lot of stuff, and I've done it much more briefly than I probably should. And I'd like to hear from you if there are any thoughts that you have.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
How does the I am, isn't that how Moses identifies himself to the people in bondage? How does that
No, Moses says, God says, I am.
Yeah.
Remember, God appears to Moses and says, I am that I am, or I will be what I will be. It's, you can translate it either way because of the Hebrew language problems. But at any rate, Moses goes down to his people and says, I am, has told me. But then quickly God adds what? I'm the God of your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And he adds that I will deliver you from the land of Egypt, from your suffering. Okay?
Yeah.
Because I am is so ambiguous, he has to say, I'm the God of your fathers. People won't believe it. Yes, other comment, yes.
Well, it sheds light on the fact why so many people were disappointed with the way Jesus lived and died, because he wasn't a powerful political figure.
That's
he
the whole
failed
argument.
Failed to be a proper king.
That's the whole argument. I mean, that's the argument in a nutshell. And that's why I'm saying, I've done this every time I've come up here. I get involved in this sort of a dialogue with the village, and I think, it's to your credit that you're open enough to engage in this dialogue. But I'm not saying which type of political leader is Moses had his faults. He was a very fallible, and Jews would say this about Moses, that he was a very fallible religious leader, lost his temper, struck the rock in anger. He was denied permission to enter the promised land. He was weak at the beginning and vacillating, and the violence occurred around Moses. But he was still lovingly called by Jews Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses, our rabbi. If you were to call someone, when my congregants say, this is our rabbi, there is no prouder moment than any rabbi could have than to be called our rabbi. What a lovely thing. Yes, back here somewhere. Yes.
Does the debate still go on in Judaism about resurrection?
The debate still goes on in Judaism about resurrection. Yes, it is not a virulent debate. And I'll tell you why it's not a virulent debate. For most enlightened Jews, resurrection is not an issue anymore. I mean, we are not, I would say, like some of the fundamentalist Christians who look for all of Israel to become settled with all of the Jews so that the Messiah could come again and Jesus will be resurrected. And there is not that feeling that we're going to be resurrected. I must tell you, it defies everything I stand for, but I want to believe in it. I want to believe in it. I don't expect it, but I want to believe it. And my resurrection would take an entirely different form. It would probably any of you read Teilhard de Chardin, except, the professors who were here have all read it. Teilhard de Chardin talks about a certain noogenesis, a form of resurrection that I could, he also talks about Christogenesis, but there's a certain form of resurrection in which could take place that doesn't involve the physical body, but would, as you know, but would take some form. There are Orthodox Jews who strongly believe in resurrection. There are Orthodox Jews who fought the establishment of the State of Israel back in 1948, because they said the State of Israel shouldn't be established until the Messiah comes, and it will be the Messiah that will lead to the establishment of the state of Israel. There are those Jews who believe that way. There are several thousands of Jews, maybe 10,000 or 20,000 Jews, who live in Israel right now today in an area called Mea Shearim, 100 gates, which is a section of Jerusalem that no Christians visit. And I don't know why, because it is a fascinating entry into the 18th century. I mean, you go back there on a Shabbos, and you'll see men in long robes walking from the bathhouse, and all activities shut down, and nothing's going on. Those people are still waiting for the Messiah to come, and with it, resurrection, and they bury their dead on the side of Mount Scopus, facing the spot in Jerusalem where Abraham supposedly took Isaac to be sacrificed, and where now the Dome of the Rock is, this Islamic temple. And if that ever happens, there'll be a terrible conflict between Jews and Muslims, which probably is going to go on anyhow. There is that group. That group in Mea Shearim will not speak Hebrew, because they say it's only the language of the Bible. They still speak Yiddish, an East European polyglot language. Beautiful language in its own right. I don't, by saying polyglot, I don't mean to demean it. And they will not fight in the Israeli army, because the Messiah for them has not come, and the resurrection has not taken place. Okay? Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Yes. Wait a minute. Yes?
I guess I'm really struck by these passages in the fact that, for me, you can see the struggle about monotheism, too. In that we think of the Ten Commandments and you shall have no other gods. And a lot of us just take that for granted, that of course monotheism is the thing. But you can really, at least for me, I can sort of see this evolution that's going on here. I wondered if you might comment on that. The tension with Aaron and the other gods. And
Judaism was always fighting this temptation, because, you know, we like to translate thou shalt have no other gods before me. We tend to be very sophisticated about our translation of it and say, well, that has to do with our materialism, which we make a god. The stock market becomes a god for some people. Our automobiles, even our children become gods in some ways. So we tend to speak of that metaphorically. But it's quite clear in these passages that other temptations to worship things were real. And one of the Midrashim talks about Moses, talks about Abraham, you know, who's considered the first Jew. And it talks about Abraham, whose father ran an idol shop. They manufactured idols, which he sold to the surrounding people. And one day, Abraham was the first of the monotheists, according to this tradition. And one day his father says to Abraham, well, I'm going to put you in charge of the store today, because I've got to take a little journey, and I'm going fishing or something like that. And Abraham is in charge of the idol shop. And according to the Midrash, Abraham takes an axe and smashes all the idols to pieces. His father comes home and says, what have you done with the family business? His father's shop. And Abraham says to his father, you see that idol over there, you know, the big one over in the corner? He said he took the axe and he smashed all these other idols. And his father says, idols can't do that. And Abraham says, aha. Okay, so here's the golden calf. Same story. Yes, there was
I'm intrigued by Moses coming down with the original set of tablets and then breaking them when he saw the Israelites worshiping another idol. But it also seems that it's the height of chutzpah for him to take God's commandments and destroy them. I mean, at this point, he's actually playing God, or seems to be.
Yep, that's chutzpah. No one ever accused Moses of not having a chutzpah. Yes, I agree with you. Yes, up there.
He was the first one to break the Ten Commandments.
I won't be back next year, but you will be. Any other comments, please? I've tried to cover an awful lot of ground, and I always hope that anything I say here will be taken in the sense of an honest exploration of not only what brings us together, but what separates us, and I think we have to understand that reverentially and with a sense of mutual appreciation. But I do think this little movement of Greek philosophy into Judaism has to be understood in order for us to see what is happening, because you can see how the ideas of heaven, how the importance of heaven, suddenly becomes much more important than the political struggles, and it becomes a political struggle too, because it involves rebellion now against the Greeks and what is going to happen. Any other comments before we conclude this? Bring this to a close. Yes.
I just have frequently in the Talmudic literature, if we're trying to look at biblical descriptions of the whole person, and this is just a catchphrase, that you can go back to the Hebrew and their sense of the person was very integrated, like body, mind, spirit, was just of a piece.
Yes.
As opposed to Greek dualism. Is that true, or?
I would say so. There is a certain unity, and I'm glad you brought that up. Is it Valerie back there?
Uh-huh.
I'm seeing you in a glare. I'm glad you brought that up, because you're going to see that difference in the Midrash with which I'm going to conclude today. You'll see how the oneness of the person, the one-dimensional structure of the person. You know, the Bible says of a king, so-and-so did that which was good in the eyes of the Lord. So-and-so did that which was evil in the eyes of the Lord. There's not that nuanced look at personality, but there is in the that's what the Midrash is trying to do. That's why over and over again we've seen how the Midrash tries to explain the motives of a Moses or his reluctance and to put it in the human dimension. Why was Moses chosen? What qualities did he have? Oh, and so forth. Okay. Any other comments?
I was struck as we were reading Exodus 32 that the Lord's wrath burned against him, and he was angry, and he said to Moses, I'm going to pull you aside, and I'm going to make a great nation of you. That's a theme throughout the Bible, that God promises to make a great nation of Abraham. He makes a great nation of Noah. He's angry at the world, and it starts over with a person, with a leader.
And every time, you know, that great nation idea, every time, here I go again. There's an old English prayer. The man standing, and it's the heart. It's the planting season, and the man stands. This is a 14th century English prayer that somebody shared with me, and it goes, "Oh God, please grant a bounteous harvest for my farm. Grant rain in its season. Grant sun in its season. Grant that the elements that thou hast prepared will be kind to me, and that I will have a bounteous, bounteous harvest. As for my neighbor Jack, thou mayest do as thy will." Well, yes, there's that promise over and over again that God, and that God will deliver this people. And Moses holds God to it. Moses says, that's one of the things that Moses says to God, you said you're going to do that, and the implication that this will happen is clear. The problem with it, as you've rightly surmised, I suspect, is that if that promise is taken too literally, then what the heck do we have to do? I mean, why should I, Moses, have to worry about this? Why am I involved in the first place? And in a passage I think we read yesterday, you remember God said, "I will do this for the sake of my name." That's been taken to mean God will save the people because God promised that he will save the people. But even that didn't please the rabbi. because he said, that's too easy. God will save the people because God is just. Justice is God's way. So there's that dual focus. Now, we're going to come to the end of this, and I want to read a passage from the Bible and then the Midrash. Read, Daryl, if you will, read the last chapter of Deuteronomy, chapter 34. Moses is at the end of his life. God says you can't enter the promised land.
Then Moses went up from the plains of Moab to Mount Nebo and to the top of Pisgah, which is opposite Jericho. And the Lord showed him the whole land, Gilead as far as Dan, all Naphtali, the land of Ephraim and Manasseh, all the land of Judah as far as the western sea, the Negev and the plain, that is the valley of Jericho, the city of palm trees as far as Zoar. The Lord said to him, this is the land of which I swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, saying, I will give it to your descendants. I have let you see it with your eyes, but you shall not cross over there. Then Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there in the land of Moab at the Lord's command. He was buried in a valley in the land of Moab opposite Beth Peor, but no one knows his burial place to this day. Moses was 120 years old when he died. His sight was unimpaired and his vigor had not abated. The Israelites wept for Moses in the plains of Moab 30 days. Then the period of mourning for Moses was ended. Joshua, son of Nun, was full of the spirit of wisdom because Moses had laid his hands on him, and the Israelites obeyed him, doing as the Lord had commanded Moses. Never since has there arisen a prophet in Israel like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face. He was unequaled for all the signs and wonders that the Lord sent him to perform in the land of Egypt, against Pharaoh and all his servants and his entire land, and for all the mighty deeds and all the terrifying displays of power that Moses performed in the sight of all Israel.
Thank you, sir. Now you notice in reading this passage, Moses simply dies. He dies. We don't know where he was buried. There's no monument to him. We don't worship him. Moses dies. And Israel weeps for him for 30 days. Well, you know, the custom now is to have, if you're Jewish and somebody dies in your family, there's a period of mourning. It's called Shloshim. Shloshim means 30 days. Taken from this passage, the 30 days of mourning. You usually don't have a wedding or go out to a party for 30 days after mourning. And then the period ends and you go about your business. It's this ends mourning, and it's okay, but it's not okay, you know. If you've lost a child, this is not going to be a very satisfying period of mourning for you. But for the traditional period of mourning, you can go about your business after 30 days. You can do stuff based on this. Moses was a human being, but a unique human being to whom God spoke. Now, I'd like to read how the Midrash, I'm going to read this, Darryl, if you don't mind. I want to end it with this because I get all torn up every night. I don't know why. You'll have to tell me afterwards. Why do I get so moved about it? Because this is entirely different the way the Midrash treats the death of Moses. But Moses suddenly is not like a human being. And I just want to read this to you. At the end of a moment, a heavenly voice was heard declaring, "The end, the time of your death has come." Now, Moses does not go easily to his death. Death is not easy for him. Said Moses to God, "Master of the universe, remember the day when thou didst reveal thyself unto me in the bush. And thou didst say to me, come now therefore, and I will send thee unto Pharaoh, that thou mayest bring forth my people, the children of Israel. Remember the time when I abode on Mount Sinai for 40 days and 40 nights. I implore thee, do not hand me over into the hand of the angel of death. Thereupon a heavenly voice was heard saying to him, "Fear not, I myself will attend to you and your burial." At that hour Moses arose and sanctified himself like the seraphim, and God came down from the highest heaven to take away the soul of Moses. And with him were three ministering angels, Michael, Gabriel, and Zagzagel. Michael laid out his beard, Gabriel spread out a fine linen at one side and Gabriel on the other. God said, "Moses, fold your eyelids over your eyes," and he did so. He then said, "Place your hands upon your breast," and he did so. Forthwith the Holy One, blessed be he, summoned the soul from the midst of the body, saying to her, "My daughter, I have fixed the period of thy stay in the body of Moses at 120 years. Now thy end has come, depart, delay not." Whereupon she replied, "This soul, Master of the universe, I know that thou art the God of the spirits and all souls, the souls of the dead and the living are in thy keeping, and thou hast created and formed me and placed me within the body of Moses for 120 years. And now is there a body in the world purer than the body of Moses, in which there was never been any... There's never been an offensive smell, nor worm, nor maggot, nor any kind of vermin. Therefore I love him, and I do not desire to leave him." Whereupon God exclaimed, "Soul, go forth, do not delay, and I will raise thee to the highest heaven, and will place thee under the throne of glory next to the cherubim, seraphim, and the other troops of angels. I implore thee, let me remain in the body of Moses." Therefore God kissed Moses and took away his soul with a kiss of the mouth. And God, if one might say so, wept. The shoes that were taken off at the burning bush are now taken off one final time. And God, if I might say so, wept. Thank you.